In just a moment, the American Forum. Monday evening on NBC means time for the Telephone Hour, a musical favorite for many years. Each week, the Telephone Hour brings you a half-hour concert direct from the stage of Carnegie Hall in New York, the home of great music, with Donald Voorhees conducting the Telephone Hour Orchestra and featuring a famous guest artist from the opera or concert stage. Tomorrow night, the soloist will be world-renowned contralto Marian Anderson. So be on hand tomorrow evening when NBC brings you the Telephone Hour. It's the best in musical listening. Now, the American Forum on NBC. Freedom of discussion, the freedom of all Americans to hear all sides of important issues and decide accordingly. The National Broadcasting Company presents America's leading discussion program, founded and produced by Theodore Granick, the American Forum. This evening, the American Forum presents another timely transcribed discussion of importance to you. The subject, business mergers, helpful or harmful. Our speakers this evening are Mr. Edward F. Howery, Chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, and Mr. Wendell Berg, former Assistant Attorney General and head of the Antitrust Division, Department of Justice. We'll begin our discussion in a moment after this message of importance. This message is directed to all young men between the ages of 17 and 34, men in good physical condition who want to get in on the ground floor of aviation. The best way to accomplish this is to become an airman in the United States Air Force. You see, in the Air Force, you receive the finest jet technical training from top experts, men who have been in jet aviation from its beginning. You learn a wide selection of specialized subjects, including radar, mechanics, and electronics. And you receive valuable experience that will secure your future for life, whether you're in the Air Force or out. You'll enjoy the opportunities of world travel and discover the thrill of wearing the Air Force Blue, the uniform of the greatest young men's team in the country. So if you think you can qualify, act now to ensure your future and your country's future by learning jet aviation. See your nearest Air Force recruiter right away. You'll go places faster as an airman in the United States Air Force. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the American Forum. And here is our moderator, Stephen McCormick.
In recent months, there has been a considerable increase in business mergers in banking, in the automobile and chemical industries, and other fields. And since the coalition of companies in many industries may affect the free enterprise system and Americans as a whole, there's the timely question, are mergers helpful or harmful? Our guests today, Edward Howery and Wendell Berg, are authorities in this question. And to query these gentlemen is an audience panel of expert questioners, with Mr. Borkin having the first question. Go ahead, Mr. Borkin.
Mr. Howery, in the automobile industry in recent years, there's been a rash of mergers. Hudson and Nash, Packard and Studebaker, Willys and Kaiser. Do you view with alarm? Do you point with pride? Or is it a matter of no concern that this movement seems to be taking place?
Well, I don't do either one or the other. The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice did not object to either the Kaiser-Willis merger or the Nash-Hudson or the Studebaker-Packard. And I have a little chart here, and I'd like to explain that in detail. But I think first I should give my friend Wendell Berg a chance to answer the question.
All right, Mr. Berg. I think the outstanding misfortune of the automobile industry is the predominant power of General Motors. And I think that government agencies concerned with the monopoly problem would do well to give serious study to the question of whether or not some action should be taken against General Motors. As far as the merger of the smaller companies goes, Nash, Studebaker, Packard, it may be that those particular mergers will strengthen competition by putting them in a better position to compete with the giant.
Well, Mr. Howery?
I wonder if I may add a little bit, because this is one of the most interesting questions that we have in the whole merger field. I've prepared a little chart here, which I hope you can see. Yes, that's the automobile chart. You'll notice that number one, that's General Motors, has 52.5% of the passenger car production. That is, in the first 11 months of 1954. Number two is Ford. Number three is Chrysler. Now, number four is Studebaker and Packard combined, and they have only 2.2 of the autumn passenger car production in the first 11 months of 54. Then American Motors, that is Hudson and Nash Calvinator combined, have only 1.9, and Kaiser Willis have 0.3%. Mm-hmm. Now, we were confronted with the question whether we should prevent the mergers 4, 5, and 6. We felt that they were losing position volume-wise. They needed dealer distribution throughout the country. They needed better access to materials and supplies, and they needed to fill out their product lines. For instance, Kaiser and Willis. Kaiser didn't have a station wagon and a Jeep, and Willis didn't have passenger cars. So, while we didn't like to do it, the commission did not deny, and I would be the last to deny, that there is an unfortunate concentration of production in the automobile field. But that was an existing situation, which no one could do anything about. That is, as far as these three mergers were concerned.
Mr. Hill.
Do you think, then, that there might very well be some antitrust proceedings with respect to the automobile industry rather than an attempt to strengthen the weak people so that they can compete with the big one?
I know of none pending. We are not now investigating the automobile industry. The Department of Justice may be. I don't know.
Well, sir, how much of the automobile industry
Mr. Krebs, you want to hold it a minute. Mr. Burge.
Well, of course, under the Sherman Act, the government has power to proceed to break up monopolies. And if the General Motors were deemed to have reached the place where it was had the power to exclude competitors from the market, was doing it, had unfair competitive advantage because of its size, was abusing that power, there is, in the Sherman Act, power to seek dissolution or divestiture and accomplish effective relief.
Mr. Krebs.
Well, sir, my statistics are very weak, but as I figure it, GM has an advantage of 150-1 over the smallest of those combinations. Now, how much of a predominance has to exist before we have a monopoly situation?
Well, one judge said 90% was too much, 60% might be dangerous, but I think he said 30% was all right. I believe that was Judge Leonard Hand in the Alcoa case, but those were figures which applied to a particular industry. What they might be in some other industry, no one can tell.
Mr. McGovern.
Well, Mr. Howery, do I understand from that chart that you just presented to us there that as long as there is one predominant company in the field, that you feel that the merger of the smaller companies is not unwise from the standpoint of the public?
No, I don't particularize as to any principle. We looked at the automobile industry. And we felt in the automobile industry, with these three giants, if you want to call them that, that it was wise, under the particular circumstances and facts which confronted us, to let these six smaller companies combine into three. Now, we didn't for a minute consider letting General Motors combine with anyone else. That question wasn't before us. And I think I could almost say in advance that we would not approve a merger of any of the smaller companies with one of the larger companies.
Mr. Krebs?
Yet within the last year or so, hasn't General Motors taken over Euclid Road Machinery Company?
I don't know.
Well, Mr. Howery, what Morgan. I'm concerned about is not that you would permit General Motors to merge with them. That's obvious that you wouldn't. But General Motors might gobble them up. As the result of the failure of these companies, not being in a position to compete in this market. And most of us are concerned with the fact that their weakened position due to the enormous strength of General Motors is troublesome. I know you'd object to General Motors merging with the United States. And you wouldn't object to the very small companies merging. But I'd like to know the area that you would permit it.
Well, in the steel company, for example, in the steel industry, the Department of Justice refused to permit, now, the number two company and the number six company to merger, Bethlehem and Youngstown. If you can cast your eye on that chart, gentlemen, you will see that Bethlehem had 15.1%.
Is this the right?
That's the wrong chart. I'm very sorry.
Let's put this over here.
We'll put that away, or I'll use it again. Bethlehem is number 2 with 15.1%, and Youngstown's number 6 with 5%. Now, there they thought that such a merger would be bad, that it would be an unfortunate concentration of two very substantial companies. That merger was disapproved on the facts and circumstances of that case.
Is that the way you feel about it, Mr. Burge?
Well, I don't think that the percentage of control in the industry is the only test. I think it's pertinent, certainly, but I think there are other things. It might be in one industry that a 30 or 40% control coupled with a near monopoly over the natural resources necessary would create a monopolistic situation where in another industry, two or three companies having approximately 30% each, but a state of competition, would be all right. I think there are many factors that have to be taken into account in weighing whether or not a large company has monopolistic power. And I think, Chairman Howery, that your opinion in the Pillsbury Mills case, in which you outlined all the various factors that go into weighing a monopoly situation, on the whole, states the law pretty well. The only thing was, I wasn't clear from that, whether you take into account only the amount of competition that is left after a merger is consummated, or whether you also consider the amount of competition that is taken from the market. And I think that both are pertinent factors.
I certainly agree, Wendell. I agree with that. You'd consider both and many other factors. In fact, the commission is now making an investigation of mergers, an economic investigation, and we're trying to find out what the motives and causes are behind the merger movement. I don't want to make a speech here, but I think it'd be interesting to add that there have been two other major merger movements in this country, one at the turn of the century, which was the great trust-forming era, and one in the 1920s. And there they really had some mergers. I think this third movement is perhaps a little less significant than the other two. You'll recall in the first one, the bankers used to put them together and say that we'll put Worthington Pump and International Nickel together and get Pumper Nickel.
Mr. Krebs.
Your comparison with previous trends of trust building or mergers is interesting because I've noticed a couple of characteristics of this current wave that haven't apparently appeared in others. One is the trend toward diversification, a company taking over manufacturing types, lines, completely outside of its regular line. You think that's significant, a significant change?
Let's ask Mr. Burge if he feels that's true.
I would think that it might be, although I hadn't really considered that particular question. I would like to ask Mr. Howery, if I may, whether these previous merger trends that he spoke of in the 20s and in the early 100s could possibly have been consummated as they were if the Anti-Merger Act, which is an amendment to the Clayton Act, which says that any merger which substantially lessens competition or tends to create a monopoly is illegal, whether those trends could have occurred if there had been the Anti-Merger Act on the book and if it had been enforced.
I don't think they could have. I think that the new law is going to be very helpful, and that goes right to the point also that Mr. Krebs raised, that the new law prevents not only the horizontal merger, that is the merger between competitors in the same line and in the same area, but it prevents vertical mergers, backward mergers for sources of supply, vertical mergers for outlets, retail stores, but also conglomerate mergers, which are mergers of different types of business. And I think my observation is that there have probably been in sheer numbers, more conglomerate mergers, more diversification of products in order to spread the risk and in order not to put all the eggs in one basket. But that's a very important motive, but there are others. I've got five or six motives listed.
Chairman Howery. Mr. Hill.
One thing that interests me in with respect to the 1950 Act is that it continues in the law itself the language to substantially lessen competition, so that there is a great deal of room for variations as far as how that particular law will be administered. Do you think that the enforcement of the antitrust or the anti-merger law is going to be strengthened within the immediately foreseeable future by the present administration?
I most certainly do. I think that the new law and the new tools we have to work with will strengthen it very materially. Well, we have three cases pending now.
Mr. Burge, good.
Why, Mr. Howery, the I'm advised, and I think you are too, that Senator Kefauver intends to introduce a bill which would give the Federal Trade Commission the duty to pass on mergers in advance. Now, it seems to me there's a good deal of merit to that. It's a good deal easier not to scramble eggs than to unscramble them after they've been scrambled. And it's very hard for lawyers in good conscience and who really want to advise their clients to keep within the law to advise whether or not a particular merger will meet with the favor or disfavor of your commission and the Department of Justice after it's consummated. And I'm inclined to favor that law. I wonder what you think about it.
Mr. Howery.
Well, that's a very difficult question. Puts me right squarely on the spot, because Senator Kefauver asked me the same question in writing, and I replied in writing that the Attorney General's committee was studying the question, and I would withhold comment. I think I'd better withhold comment now, except I would point out that it does meet one requirement that Congress laid down, namely that the commission should try to stop these mergers before they happen. If we had to issue a certificate of convenience and necessity, so to speak, before they could merge, it would certainly do that. The other side of the coin is that we have a private, capitalistic, competitive enterprise system, and if the Federal Trade Commission has to issue a license to a businessman before he can merge in a case where a merger would vitalize competition, as we think the automobile mergers probably have done, why then government would really be getting into business, and whether I would want to do that or not, I will reserve judgment for now.
Well, this committee you mentioned, when will that come out with its recommendations, Mr.
The Attorney General's committee, of which both Mr. Burge and I are members, and I might say he's a very good, hard-working member of it, we hope they will make their report sometime in February or March.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Howery, we're a little disturbed by the, as you say, the other side of the coin. If the merger of Republic and Youngstown is contrary to public policy because of the percentage they would equal, what I'm concerned about is that U.S. Steel has more than they have right now. General Motors has more than almost all the rest of the automobile industry combined, including Chrysler and Ford. On the other side of the coin, if we're discussing mergers, I think we ought to think in terms of dissolutions. Don't you think we ought to have a rash of dissolution suits?
Well, I don't know of any existing law under which we could dissolve General Motors or dissolve U.S. Steel unless it is found that they have violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act, and that is that they are already a monopoly or a monopolistic. I think that the new Merger Act doesn't deal with that. Perhaps it should have, but it doesn't.
I'd like to ask Mr. Burge that question.
Mr. Burge's opinion on that.
It seems to me that more dissolution suits are called for by the facts of our current economic situation than are being brought. Now, when we come to, we've talked a lot about General Motors. I think there's one other advantage there that should be mentioned, and that is the great integration of General Motors and the fact, for example, of its close connection with DuPont. Now, the automobile industry is a large consumer of chemicals, and the government brought a suit to separate the DuPont interests from General Motors. DuPont, I believe the facts were undisputed, owned about 23% of the stock, and I guess one of the issues would be whether or not that constitutes control. Ordinarily, in a large corporation, that would constitute control because of the diversification of holdings that are listed as General Motors is. But I'm concerned whether or not the government is going to appeal that case, because I don't think a matter of such public interest as this is, and where so much money and time, both of government and defense, have been spent on a trial, that the final solution of it should rest on the opinion of one man. I certainly hope the government appeals the DuPont General Motors case, and I believe that public opinion will convince the Department of Justice that it should. In fact, I predict, without any authority for doing so other than my own hunch and having been a member of that department for some years, that that case must be appealed.
Mr. McGovern.
Well, getting back to the automotive situation again, was going to ask whether or not, Mr. Howery, you would agree that inasmuch as General Motors has better than one half of the total production in the industry, if these three small companies who have recently merged should not be able to survive in the coming year and themselves sought to merge, since in the aggregate they would have less than 5%, wouldn't you agree that they, of course, were entitled to merge?
Well, I don't know. That's one thing that's very difficult to foresee or to prophesy. I insist, and I wrote an opinion outlining this, that every case must be examined on its own merits. We must look at the relevant economic and competitive factors existing in that market, in that industry, at that time. And to just go out and say, let's dissolve General Motors, let's dissolve U.S. Steel, you just can't do that that easily in this country with its big business, its big labor unions, its big government. And I don't believe in concentration. I think General Motors is too big. U.S. Steel has 30%. It may be too big, but that has happened since 1900.
Yes,
can't wipe them out today overnight without very serious thought about it.
I was suggesting that if General Motors is so large that in your own mature judgment, it represents the justification for the little companies merging. Little companies like Nash and Hudson, who have a history that goes back long prior to General Motors. Caveat then with the General Motors isn't too large in that sense of the word.
Well, let's concede it is too large. Then the problem is what we're going to do about it. The remedy in these cases is probably the most difficult problem of all, and being a government official, I have to think of that side of it. What can we do and what should we do about it? Now, that's the reason, if I may just add, why we're making this economic investigation. We think that we must be careful in applying the principles of law to the economic facts of life, the realities of the marketplace. And we're making this study to find out why these mergers take place, whether they're intended to lessen competition, whether they want prestige or power, or whether it's the desire of a small firm to grow and be able to compete with his larger competitor, whether tax losses or financial matters, or what is the reason for the merger. And when we find out that, then we'll know what to do about it.
Mr. Krebs.
Sir, didn't your commission issue a long and very detailed report just within the last 6 months concerning the changing concentration of power in the economic system?
Yes, we issued a report on concentration as such, but it had nothing to do with the merger movement, nor did it deal with the causes or motives behind the merger.
Mr. Burge, is this committee activity something new, or is this one of those things that happens regularly?
Are you speaking of the Attorney General's committee that was previously referred to? Well, that committee was appointed in the late summer of 1953, consisting of some close to 60 men, mostly from private life, Mr. Howery and Secretary Weeks, I believe, and Judge Barnes of the Antitrust Division are the only government officials. Most of the men were practicing lawyers, although perhaps a dozen of them are professors. They were commissioned to survey the whole antitrust field and determine, or rather recommend, what legislation may be necessary to implement the antitrust laws, also to give their recommendations as to enforcement policies. It was really a working committee. There wasn't much of a staff. The men met frequently in groups, each assigned different subjects, and then ultimately the group reports of the different working groups were combined into a draft of a committee report. It's been revised several times. The committee met for 4 days early in December, and as Mr. Howery has stated, there will probably be a final report in a couple of months.
Yes, Mr. Balkin.
For every Wendell Burge on that committee, there are 10 who I think are unlike Wendell Burge. We get the impression they have given the fox the right to guard the henhouse, and we're awfully worried about it. And along that line, we're a little concerned with a number of other things that are happening. The fear of the administration to enforce competition in the attempt to get the Dixon-Yates contract.
We've got enough time, I think, probably maybe to talk about that.
Well, Dixon Yates isn't in my field, and I have no comment to make on it, nor does it involve mergers or antitrust.
May I just say one thing?
Yes.
That there's a good article in the January Atlantic Monthly on the Dixon Yates deal, and I recommend to everyone listening that they read it.
Well, I'd like to get on one other thing.
To comment on this committee. He's so off base that if we'd let it go very far, somebody might believe him.
Well,
that's his question of having 10... like myself, to one of Wendell Burge. Now, I'll admit Wendell Burge can make five of normal people, but not 10. Now, that committee, that Attorney General's committee, is a wonderful cross-section of brains and philosophy and ability. And for anyone to suggest it's loaded or packed or is anything different from what it is just doesn't know what he's talking about, and that includes you, Mr. Borkin.
On this, I agree with Mr. Howery. I admire the committee.
Then we'll wait
much.
For the report.
All right, let's go ahead to your other question.
I'd like to. I'm a little concerned about a number of other things. The SEC is attempting to eliminate the competitive bidding on the financing of public utilities. And that was a battle that we won back in 1940. Since then, $19 billion of financing has gone by competitively. Are you, as a spokesman for the antitrust principle in the present administration, going to say a word about it, maybe to prevent the elimination of that idea?
Well, I'll have to ask you to restate it. You said the SEC.
The SEC has proposed an amendment to Rule U50, which would permit the operating companies to, within states to do their own financing without regard to competitive bidding. I would say the public has gained $500 million in the last 10 years by competitive bidding. I think the administration seems to be a little frightened of competition.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about, really, because I don't know about the SEC, but I can assure you that the theory of competitive bidding is so deeply embedded in our antitrust philosophy that we will never give it up.
Good.
But let's get back to mergers a minute,
yes,
may
go
we?
Go ahead, Mr. Howery.
I would,
Mr. Krebs has a short question. Well,
I would like to question the administration's policy on mergers, inasmuch as the Attorney General, when he made the decision in Bethlehem and was it Republic, stated that while the law prevented the merger, he considered the law much too tough and would be in favor of amending it to soften it. Now, what is the administration's policy?
I know the statement of which you made, and I did not so read it. And I think that interpretation is neither his interpretation and it certainly isn't mine. They don't think the law is too tough. They think the law is going to be difficult to administer, but I don't believe for a minute that we are going to weaken or ask that Section 7 of the Clayton Act be weakened. I'd like to add this, that the rash of mergers in this country are in the baking, paper, textile, dairy, chemical, and primary metals field. We haven't discussed any of those, and I'd also like
to
add
more time for it,
that we brought more antitrust suits and Federal Trade Commission suits than any previous administration. Not growing soft.
I just want to say one thing in closing. Though I served in a previous administration, I want to give high commendation to Judge Barnes, the present head of the Antitrust Division, who I think, notwithstanding many difficulties, is doing a swell job.
I must interrupt, gentlemen, because I notice our time is up. We certainly do thank you, and thank you very much for coming here today, Mr. Edward Howery and Mr. Wendell Burge. And thank you, gentlemen. The nation's first discussion program, The American Forum, is now in its 26th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Stephen McCormick bidding you goodbye.
In most parts of the country, cold weather has set in for a long stay. And for that reason, I'd like to pass along a few motoring hints to help bring you safely through the winter.